Welcome back to Rock Under Fire, episode We Don't Know.
We made one episode in a row with the full cast.
Yeah.
We were up to one.
Stick Nixon is not here tonight.
Stick couldn't join us. We had a great show planned out, too. We had a couple of guests.
Stay tuned, though, because that is coming up, and I look forward to that because I got my list.
I was at 15 songs, so I was trying to narrow it down to 10, and then I was like, well, we can have a few runners up.
It's funny you said that because I got to like 11 or 12, and I said, you know what? I'm going to just have to stop there. I don't want to go crazy with this because I could have. And one of them came on the radio, and I quick jotted it down in my phone. I was like, oh, this is definitely fucking one of them.
Yeah. So this is the Rock Under Fire podcast. We want to thank everybody who's been supporting us and still sticking with us.
Yeah,
a few of you who are left. And we want to welcome any new listeners to the show. You'll find us on iTunes, YouTube, something called Stitcher. Do people listen to anything on Stitcher? Do you know anything about it?
I think I listened to Todd's radio show, or Aaron and Todd's radio show.
On Stitcher? I know they're on Podbean.
No, it was Podbean. That's what it was. Thank you. It was Podbean. Yeah. There's too many of them out there. You know, I listen to our show on iTunes because I have an iPhone.
I'm quite a few shows behind on Aaron and Todd's
show. I am as well.
I've really been slacking ever since, like, right before the holidays. You know, I just kind of stopped listening to everything and just...
I have all this fucking free time lately, too, and you figure I'd be listening to it, but no. Hey, I want to bring something up, man. I thought this was really cool. The band Anthrax was out in Albuquerque, and they met the mayor out there. His name is Tim Keller. Mm-hmm. He's a huge fucking metal fan, and so the guys from Anthrax were out there with him, and they got a picture of it on Facebook. If any of you are Anthrax fans, go to their site on their page on Facebook. And apparently, he's like a huge Metallica. I mean, in the picture, he's wearing like a remember when they toured the Big Four?
Right.
He's wearing like that T-shirt and shit like that. And so they said he's a super metalhead, literally the metal mayor, they're calling him. And they're saying it's the future of government. I wanted to throw that out there because I thought it was really cool.
I heard they're trying to put another one of those Big Fours together. And
they better do it quick because Slayer's done.
Into it, like, except Metallica.
Yeah, you know, and Dave Mustaine, I think, had some bad, not bad things to say, but he wasn't too thrilled about that either. I guess there's still some bad blood between the two of them.
I know. He said something to the effect of maybe we could do the Big Three and number five.
Yeah.
Which would be, I forgot the name.
Overkill, maybe? I would throw Overkill in there. Overkill has to make that list.
I don't know if it was Overkill.
Could be Testament.
Some band that I was like, really? Oh, was it Exodus, maybe?
Okay, it could be Exodus. Okay, that's you could put them in the argument.
So wait, the Big Four was Metallica,
yeah,
Slayer,
yep,
Megadeth,
yep,
and Anthrax.
Yeah. Now for lack of sounding like we're copying that metal show, because they had a discussion like this. And, you know, who would be that fifth band or sixth band even? And, the question comes up. Right off the bat, we said Overkill, Testament. Exodus was another good one. I wasn't even thinking of them. I would go with one of those three, to be honest with you. And Overkill, just longevity. Overkill's still floating around. They're still making records. They're still touring.
Yeah, my knowledge of metal kind of stops with Metallica.
Okay. Fair.
I don't know a damn thing about... Well, when Anthrax really broke in the 80s, I had Spreading the Disease and Among the Living. Yeah. That's my knowledge of Anthrax stops there. So
I just saw them, it was a few years back, but man, they were good. Starland Ballroom. Coincidentally, they were with Testament. It was them, Testament, and Death Angel. Great, great, great show.
And it's funny because in my high school yearbook, there's a picture where I'm wearing an Anthrax shirt.
What is it with the kids from Ford's? What is it with the kids from Ford's and their Anthrax T-shirts? Let's throw out to you. It's another throw out to what do you call it? One of our listeners. I gotta say, I really enjoyed having Sirjak here. That was one of my top three favorite episodes. It just brought me back to that time period, and you know, I left that night just thinking about that the entire time, and that era, and where I was and what I was doing.
Yeah, and I believe Mike is also now launching his own podcast for his business venture.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so it's gonna be related to that. I think he didn't give me any of the details, but he's asking a lot of questions. So, Mike, if you're listening, hey man, here's to you, man. Welcome to podcast hell. But anyway, yeah, I do have something to talk about. It seems that our podcast is taking this, I don't know, almost like unwanted left turn into, we're like reporting who died and reporting who the farewell tour is of the week.
Yeah.
And so rather than get into, you know, the fact that rock music is being hit from all sides, man, and just being, it's like a piece of paper, it's like a target, man, like one of those like paper targets that you shoot at and then the bullet holes go through it and then there's like little, barely anything of the paper left.
Yeah,
that's rock.
That little star in the middle,
and
it's blast
just like
out
with every death and every farewell tour.
Interesting you say that. I just watched the Foo Fighters on Netflix, Back and Forth, I think it was called,
right?
And I watched it after I watched the Chicago one on your recommendation. The Chicago, Peter Cetera is a jerk off, a dick.
Yeah.
The guy should be kicked out of music. What an asshole that guy was to that band. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But the Foo Fighters one, it was almost like Dave Grohl was addressing something you said personally about him being that guy. He was saying that he was at the Grammys and they were accepting a Grammy Award. And he was like, where the fuck is the rock and roll? You know, I don't want to be the fucking, you know, it's like, oh, let's call Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters. They'll do it, you know?
Exactly.
And he was kind of, he addressed that. He's like, well, where the fuck is the rock and roll? It's boy band, girl band, rap band, hybrid band, and then there's us. And I'm like, wow, he's so fucking right.
You know, the fact that rock wasn't even televised on the Grammys. And I remember last year, we tore the Grammys apart.
Yeah.
Because of that Metallica debacle with Lady Gaga.
Yeah, with Lady Gaga, yeah.
But the fact that, I mean, they didn't even televise the Rock Award. Whatever it was, but
they opened with U2 playing on a barge or some shit in front of
pretty much means that rock is that's how insignificant rock has become to the big picture.
Yep.
And not arguing with anybody that, you know, there's rock music out there and you have to look for it. Well, I don't like that you have to look for it.
Shouldn't have to look that hard.
Yeah, so I often get portrayed as the rock is dead guy. I be the bad guy. I'm the bad guy on the show because, you know, I willingly play devil's advocate in that the rock era is, in fact, over. I will argue that until, you know, they throw me in the ground.
Well, I'm beginning to agree with you because, you know, it's just harder and harder to find. And when they're not showcasing it like that, you know, I got to say, too, another Netflix thing I want to promote. The Keith Richards one was fucking fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Him recording his solo record.
Right, yeah. That's,
that was amazing, that's man. He just went through, like, all kinds of history and music.
I like when he shows you the records that when he ran into Mick Jagger in 1961 or 2 or whatever it was. The
Muddy Waters
record,
and Chuck Berry
record.
Yeah, and he goes, what are you doing with those?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where did you get those?
Yeah, man. I totally dug that. You know what else I really dug about that was him living in Jamaica. And they showed him like partying with all kinds of Rastafarians, and he looked high as a fucking kite.
Yeah.
But they were just hanging out and playing music and just jamming, and it was so cool. And who's that guitar player that he had on that record with him? He's been with like Elton John.
Waddy Wachtel or something.
Yeah, he's
like
been
that.
With like
he's
Elton
like
John's band. Yeah.
Now that's a guy who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on his own, like some special award of recognition. He's a guy that there's a handful of people that I think that the Rock Hall of Fame should ultimately give the nod to.
He would be one of them. I agree. Yeah. He's on everything. And man, again with the Chicago thing, what a great recommendation. Because, you know, that's a band that when you listen to them, the early stuff, I do enjoy a lot.
Yeah.
I really do.
I did not appreciate that band until about 2 or 3 years ago.
I appreciated them more seeing that now.
Yeah.
I mean, I did like them. You know, I'm a kid of the 70s. Yeah. You know, they were there. They were always there.
Yeah.
And you knew that the sappy stuff was coming. But, I mean, you know, before Kath's death and stuff like that, I mean, it was just, you're like, whoa, man, these guys were really fucking good.
Yeah, and they get, there's like almost like a stigma with them because of the horn section. And but that stuff rocks. Yeah. That first Chicago record, I often describe as the MC5 with horns.
Mm.
It's just, it's raw, it's angry, it's just vicious sounding. There's a lot, just the feedback is just loud and in your face. It's the sound of the turmoil of 1968. It ends like the ending of the album. You hear, yeah, you know, the whole world is watching, the whole world. Yeah. You hear the sounds of the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968, and it's just like an experience. It's an album that you have to hear from beginning to end.
And who was the was it the producer? Was it Dave Foster? Was that his name? Who started writing with Cetera?
Yeah,
what
they came and cut the
prick.
Balls off the band.
What a prick! He goes, "Well, I got 16 Grammys back there." I was like, "Fuck!" I wanted to jump into my television and slap the fucking smirk right off his face.
It's that mentality you're only good if you're judged by the amount of hit songs you have, how many Grammys you have, how many
that
fucking awards you have.
That is not what it's about.
What about the art? You know, where is the art, man? And just really quickly getting back to what I was saying before, you know, in terms of like
the
bullet holes in the sign,
yeah,
the bullet holes in rock, rock under fire after all, the bullet holes, man, just all of the stuff that is symptomatic of the insignificance of rock. Past the 90s, man, the fact that electric guitar sales are down. Kids are not buying guitars the way they did when we grew up. You know, kids are listening. You know, more kids want to be rappers now.
And they have the acoustic guitar sales are probably through the roof.
Guitar sales are up because of probably like people like Ed Sheeran and Ray from 90210.
Yeah.
You know, because that's all this stuff is. It's Ray from 90210.
Is that how do you talk to it?
Meets American Idol,
yeah,
you know? And what else? What else? You know, just
we haven't been here either for Justin Timberlake on the Super Bowl. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
No, I don't watch the Super Bowl.
But Timberlake was on at the halftime show and tried to do a little. First of all, his sound was horrible. He sounded fucking terrible.
Yeah,
he all he did was parade around and dance and say just. And the kid is very talented.
Yeah,
Let me stop short there and say the kid is very talented.
Yeah.
But he tried doing this little thing to Prince because the Super Bowl was in Minnesota, and I don't think it went too well. Should have kind of just left that alone.
They should have just, they should have got the replacements to play if it was from Minnesota. You know, let's have a replacements reunion or something. But that aside, man, I did not want to go in that direction of the fact that we keep posting shit about death and about farewell tours. But because let's do some celebrating this time. The other thing that we post about inevitably is every time that there's a massive anniversary of something, because rock has gotten so old now, we've approached, there's always a 50th anniversary of some landmark album or a 40th anniversary of some landmark album. Yeah. When this shit gets old, we could go into the 80s and talk 30th anniversaries if we want to talk about 1988. But this week, yesterday in particular, we are recording this on Sunday night, so yesterday, February 10th, was the 40th anniversary of the first Van Halen record.
Wow, Diamond Dave,
yeah.
All right.
So it took us 17 minutes to get here, but that's where...
Van Halen.
No, I know, but this is we've arrived at our topic.
Mighty Van Halen.
So when we said, you know, we got to cancel our guests, postpone our guests. We didn't cancel our guests. Our guests, the haters, will be on our show at some point, maybe in a month from now. I know we need the air conditioner. It's about 55 degrees here in New Jersey,
and it's fucking hot.
55
degrees
in
this studio just heats up.
Because when you get used to -5 for, you know, basically the entire month of January, 55 degrees is fucking hot. So
the mighty Van Halen, 40 years.
I think it's a no-brainer. I didn't have to think of a time. I was like, there was not that period. I didn't have that period of, okay, what are we going to do?
And
I
love
like,
Van
we
Halen.
Are just going to talk about Van Halen.
I love Van Halen. You know me. I love me.
I'm not
Van
even
Halen.
A fan, so.
That's crazy.
I like Van Halen, but I was never really, I can't say I was a fan. I didn't wait for their new albums to come out. I didn't be like, oh, what the fuck? What's Van Halen doing? I can't wait till 1984 comes out. You know,
I got into them late.
Yeah.
So there's that, because I had to go back and get a lot of that stuff. I mean, I got into them late. I'm not going to deny that.
Yeah.
But finding that as a teenager was just fucking perfect. Every record, even right up till 84, I think every record was just, this is what I want my life to be. This is a good time. This is a party. And that's what I was doing as a teenager. This was what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it's no secret that I'm heavily influenced by David Lee Roth as a musician. I don't really sound like him when I sing at all, but that is the guy that I was like, I need to do. I want to do that. That's what I want to do.
I think if you channel anybody, now when Pat sings karaoke, Pat channels. And when I say channel, I mean like takes every little nuance and characteristic of that person's voice and becomes that person. And the two people you channel the most, I think, is Greg Allman and Ozzy.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You inhabit those songs as the character singing that, as the artist.
Two of my
you
other influences.
Those people.
And Jim Morrison would be the fourth if there were four people that got me to rock and roll.
I haven't heard you do Morrison that much.
Yeah, kind of. You know, it's not really the thing to do at karaoke. It's like, meh. But Jim is definitely...
I did Crystal Ship once.
I did L.A. Woman. But those four. I mean, Ozzy, obviously, because of Sabbath. And Jim, I love the Doors. But Dave was... You know, who didn't want to be fucking Diamond Dave? You were a vocalist. Who didn't want to be Diamond David Lee Roth? That guy had it all. You know, those pictures of him holding a bottle of Jack Daniels and the cops are escorting him. Yeah, it was staged.
Yeah.
But they're escorting him out of the back of the fucking arena. And, you know, the women and everything. Yeah. That he, you know, the epitome of rock and roll, you know?
Let's approach this in a couple different ways. Let's first go back to... Let's put it in the context of its times. Now, you got into Van Halen later.
Yeah.
How much later? Was it in the 80s?
Yeah,
was
80s.
It,
definitely in the 80s.
Was Dave...
As 84.
It was around 84?
Yeah, it was about 84 when 84 was out because of... I know when we did our Christmas episode, when I used Drop Dead Legs, I did that because of the guitar work, but I think I'll Wait on that record. Love it. Just brings me to a specific place, specific moment. I remember it like it was yesterday. And that song brings me to that spot.
Right.
But I wanted to have a more guitar-driven record, more guitar-driven song for for that episode. So I went with Drop Dead Legs. But what was your question? I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
No. There was no question. I just wanted to know. Like,
about 84,
when,
yeah.
Yeah. I remember being very well aware of Van Halen, I would say... In the late 70s, I remember, you know, because when the time that the first record came out, I mean, were you aware of them as like, you figure 78, we're 8 years old. We're 7 years old going into eight. So in early 78.
Everybody Wants Some, but that was later.
Yeah. I was into, you know, obviously we were into Kiss
yeah.
in early 78. And I had just gotten Alive 2 for Christmas. Going into 78, you know, double platinum was about to come out. So that was my world.
Yeah.
Everything revolved around that band. But I remember soon after, I guess over the next year or two, you know, we would buy our records either in Two Guys, Corvettes.
Mine was James Way up in upstate New York.
Or ShopRite. Yeah. I remember there was a record section in ShopRite. So I would go with
about 10 years ago, you get CDs
to,
in ShopRite.
Yeah. She'd be doing the shopping, and I'd be off either looking at magazines or else looking at records. And I remember I used to see this record with the four squares with the four pictures, and I remember seeing this, you know, Van Halen 2, this big VH in the middle of the record. Like, what is this? But it was something that it didn't grab me enough to say, like, I usually, you know, you have to hear something first. It wasn't like the 80s where I would walk into Vintage Vinyl and see like the cover of TNT Knights of the New Thunder and see like this record cover looks so badass, I'm going to buy it. This band's got to be good. You know, I wasn't buying records based on their album covers yet like I did in the 80s with all the metal. In the 70s, of course, you know, your parents were still buying your records because, you know, you were 8, 9 years old.
And then you were thumbing through theirs, maybe some old stoner secrets that they had laying around.
So I guess when Van Halen 1 came out, when the first, you know, the debut record, I wasn't even aware of them. I guess over the next year, I used to see the record, but it didn't click. Like they could have had 10 albums out for all I knew. Mm. I didn't know who they were. You know, I just remember looking at them. They looked badass.
Oh, and when I did get into them, it was just full throttle. I needed everything. You know, as soon as I could go out and buy another record, I did. And I went all the way back and started, you know, from one and worked my way forward.
Yep. And I guess as you get into where I really started to hear them was just, you know, my group of friends at the time, and a few of them had done this show. Our friend Eric, who did our show with Jim back in August. They started putting together a band, and you know, you start hanging out with them. So that my first exposure to Van Halen was through Eric, yeah. I think.
Trying probably, play, and he was playing the leads and stuff like
and
that.
And he was stuff, at that yeah. point, he was just playing Eddie yeah. note for note, and he was like 13 years old at yeah. the time. So, but going back, it became very clear to me that two things: I wasn't crazy about Van Halen. I wasn't, you know, there was something, but the first album was undeniably great. That was the one that I kept going back to. I wasn't crazy about, you know, and people will have my head for this, but, you know, people love Fair Warning. It's
my
like
favorite record.
Up between Fair Warning. Record. I mean, is it consensus?
I think Eric
that
even agreed because we got into a brief discussion
Eric,
about
I think
them.
Eric is a Fair Warning guy. If you gave him two seconds to come up with Van Halen's best album, Eric would probably say Fair Warning.
I think he peaked at that record. I did.
I mean, for me, I always liked the first two Van Halen albums. Those were the ones for me that...
And one is great. I mean, one brought us Van Halen, but man, Fair Warning is... Whew,
yeah.
Blistering. Even the mellow stuff is just... Because he had so many new techniques that he was, you know, that people hadn't heard. And, you know, different flanges and choruses and stuff.
Dave got a lot of stuff from the front man, the guy from Black Oak, Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently,
yeah.
I don't know.
He was into like show singers and shit too. I mean, he was, you know, he's a singer.
Yeah,
every band should want David Lee Roth, a David Lee Roth style guy as their singer, minus the attitude, minus the, you know, you want that charisma.
Yeah,
you don't want everything else that comes with it. All the other baggage you don't need.
I think the problem for me, and for years, I've been trying to pinpoint. I've always had a problem with my lack of enthusiasm for Van Halen. I could never put my finger on it because I know they're a great band. They are revered. Eddie is to be bowed to, man. He's that good. He's that important in you know, the, if you go through the whole lineage of
guitar. Yeah.
And I don't know if it was quite David Lee Roth. I don't know if it was just that laid back West Coast thing. A lot of it has to do, for me, Michael Anthony is a great, you know, one of the coolest dudes I've ever heard interviewed. I never met him, obviously, but, yeah. You know, I mean, I always enjoy watching him talk and listening to him talk and just listening to interviews with Michael Anthony. I never dug his background vocals. That high-pitched falsetto, I was just kind of like the background vocals of Van Halen for me. It was just kind of like a...
They fucked him so bad, too.
I know. The guy is like...
Even before they threw him out of the band.
What they did to him, man.
Even before they kicked him out of the band.
Yeah.
Royalties, they fucking screwed him hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the main reasons why they kept him around was because of his backing vocals. I dug that about him.
And you know what? But over the years, you know, I've kind of come to terms with that. I'm like, you know, it's just them. It's Van Halen. That's their fucking sound. Yeah. There was nothing before them that sounded like that. There was nothing after them that sounded like that. There's only a handful of bands that nobody can touch in terms of their sound. It's such an original, unique sound. I think The Doors is one. I think Steely Dan is another. And I think Van Halen is one of those bands that they sound like
Tool.
They're just rootless.
Tool.
I don't mean ruthless. I mean rootless. Root. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, we obviously know that Eddie had influences, but...
they don't come out in this. They don't really come out in this sound.
You know, the production, just the sound, and I always had a problem with their sound. I always thought their sound was kind of too thin.
It was very
again,
thin.
It's just me.
But I think that's it. I think that is from that era, period. Because there's a lot of music from then that just I listen back and I'm like, Oh, it just sounds so thin. It's just very tinny.
Well, there are without Dave, they're obviously, you know, they're a three piece. They don't have a second guitarist, and I don't believe, I might be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I have not analyzed the shit out of Van Halen records. I haven't listened to them enough to be able to speak authoritatively. Yeah, they kind of didn't do much overdubbing in terms of the guitar. No. So whereas like
later on,
bands that like even like The Who, where Townsend was by himself. There would be other guitars. Sometimes you would need another guitarist on stage, like later on. Van Halen left it at what it was when they recorded, I think.
That was part of the allure of it, thing, I think, too, that raw, that live sound. That's, I think, what made them sound so good on vinyl.
Yeah, so, I mean, recorded. In terms of when you sound so powerful, where you have a rhythm section that sounds as powerful as Led Zeppelin or The Who, I think sometimes it kind of made them sound a little bit on the thin side. I don't know if it could have been the drums. It could have been, it could be me talking out my ass.
Maybe
I don't know.
He was the engineer. I don't know.
But it wasn't until recently, you know, I guess in the last 5 years where I just kind of laid that to rest and said, you know what? It's fucking Van Halen, man. It is what it is. They're just one of those bands that you cannot put a label on them. I've kind of come to the conclusion, a couple of conclusions about Van Halen, but, you know, without hanging a label on them. I think they were kind of like somebody asked, like, I don't know if it was a conversation about hair metal, like who was the first hair metal band, and, you know, that term, which is kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if I like it or not. But
yeah, I agree with you on that.
Nobody said hair metal back in the 80s. It was just metal, and... I think in many ways they were like the archetype.
You wouldn't go with like a New York Dolls,
not
or something?
The archetype. They were kind of like the template, like the, what do you call it? Definitely not the New York Dolls. What's the word I'm looking for?
Stereotype.
The prototype for hair metal. What
you
became hair
them,
metal?
Huh?
Yeah, because you had like the long hair. The spandex, because they were wearing spandex when, you know, before it was kind of fashionable. And they had
And they were singing about good times and girls and drinking and stuff.
The whole L.A. or the West Coast thing, the partying, and the tone of Eddie's guitar. You know, guitars didn't sound like that before Eddie, but most guitars sounded like that after Eddie. And unfortunately, that became
one of the
like
two. They,
compressed,
they either,
distorted guitar sound.
They either sounded like Eddie, and then a little later on, they sounded like Randy.
Yeah.
You had two different tones going on there for that whole 80s metal scene. Okay. All right.
But, you know, the first album.
You know, coincidentally, actually, Randy's my favorite guitar player probably of all time.
Is he?
Yeah, and Eddie's not. I like the Sabbath Ozzy thing so much more than anything else ever. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I was not like I was not a fan of Eddie. I'm just somebody that respects the hell out of him. I acknowledge him as one of the greats.
I respect it.
And Van Halen has, I mean, they did great shit.
I respect the shit out of the Stones and The Who, even. Yeah. I'm not a fan of either group, really. You know, I could take the Stones more than I could take The Who. And I'm really starting to lessen my disliking for the Stones lately. The older they get, and maybe the older I get, I guess.
Yeah. But, you know, I could just, you know, as in terms of putting on that record for the first time, and people, I did hear that for the first time.
I can only imagine.
I
know what I was like.
They were big before the album came out. They were kind of like, this is the band you got to see. They were like hot for like 2 years.
Yeah,
they even had a label.
That West Coast scene was insane. I mean, the party, they were just playing like parties and stuff. And it was just, from the way their old tour manager described it in his book, was that it was just one big giant, like, fucking, picture yourself being at the beach, like a giant beach party with these guys just playing. And they were playing covers.
Yeah. So it was very, I guess, very highly anticipated, the first album. So when it came out, it was kind of an event in a way for people who were in the know about them, saying, holy shit, like, you know, they're signed, they got an album coming out. All the stuff we've been hearing in the clubs is now going to be represented in some sort of indelible studio form.
And Warner Brothers had them by the balls. My God, did they sign such a bad deal. Oh, you got to read that book. They just signed.
That's on my list.
They signed such a horrible deal, and Warner Brothers had it. But then Warner Brothers turned around and screwed it up because they didn't read. They didn't read their own clause in the contract.
not many people do.
Van Halen got rich off of it. Thank God.
That's like the one Universal story that seems to keep threading its way through rock history is the people that got screwed over by some bad deal.
Yeah, because you're so eager at that point. I don't know, man. Maybe the guy sitting at the Court Tavern in New Brunswick still plucking away. You know, maybe that's the guy who's got it right. You know.
Yeah.
So getting back to the first Van Halen record, it's when you first, you know, my experience with it wasn't a needle on the record. Unfortunately, for the first time, it was a CD and. But my God, the first time hearing Running with the Devil.
I mean, hearing Running with the Devil for the first time, it goes into Eruption. Yes. Eruption just changed the game.
Yeah.
There was no turning back after Eruption.
No.
This is the way we're going. It's kind of like, it was one of those moments where there are a few moments in rock history where somebody comes in and you think that this is real and you think that this is the way it is and this is what everybody does, and then one person comes along and says, this is where we're going. We're gonna go this way. Elvis did that. Bob Dylan did that.
Jimi Hendrix did that. Because the Beatles had just put out their fucking epic Sergeant Pepper, and like 2 weeks later he's playing it in a fucking club, and Paul was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And we just bled, sweat, everything onto this record.
Yeah.
And this guy's playing it in such a unique way. So, yeah, you're right. There's those staples. And I hate Elvis Presley. I am notoriously one of the big Elvis haters in the world. And but you give the guy his due because that was a staple that changed. There was a new trajectory.
We could also say Chuck Berry with Elvis, because there are a lot of people, Elvis doesn't write any songs and Elvis didn't do anything. But you know what? Elvis was fucking Elvis, man. There's that moment on Ed Sullivan where, you know, I don't want to get into that.
It's a topic for another night.
But Eruption was a game changer.
That's you know what I relate it to? The movie Back to the Future, when Michael J. Fox is back in the past and he puts the headphones on his father, and I think he plays Eruption for him right through to Walkman. I mean, that's really what it was like to hear that for the first time. It was like, what the fuck is this? This is like a spaceman. This is just out there, man.
Yeah, and I he's not the first person to finger tap.
No.
But, you know, people were doing it. People knew the technique. But what he
took it to a whole nother level. Different scale. Yeah.
And, you know, there were things going on in music that, guitar-wise, I mean, like Tom Scholz from Boston 2 years before put out, you know, the first Boston record. But that was like totally, in terms of, we're talking about technology, the use of technology and what he did on that first record and all
that
the
sound,
overdubs.
That clean sound.
He had a very unique sound, and that's another guitar sound that was never duplicated by anybody. That's another band that has their own unique sound. But
there's
this
some
is a guy
Eddie
that
stuff
would sit there and overdub something for like 50 guitars.
But there's some Eddie stuff that almost sounds similar to the Scholz. You're onto something there. Because of that, I guess there's a flange effect that I know Eddie was very popular. It was very popular in Eddie's work.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, in some of those clean tracks, there's a similarity there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very unique spin on that.
Yeah.
And some of Eddie's stuff early, I love some of that clean guitar sound that he had. It had a, you know, whatever, you guitar gurus out there, even you, Mike, you know, I know flange, that's it, you got me there, and some chorus and delay.
Yeah.
And it might have been just those three effects, I don't know.
Yeah, so, it was a game changer in terms of sound with the guitar. Like you said, like the party nature of the whole, the attitude of David Lee Roth, good times, you know, driving up the way you said it, driving down
the parkway,
whatever,
in the summer
with the
top down.
And, you know, in this case, in their case, it'd be the Pacific Coast Highway.
Yeah.
You know, the whole tumultuous whatever of the 70s, you know, coming out of the 60s and whatever that was, man, it was a lot of, it was just dark, man. A lot of the early 70s was just dark, and even glam was dark. Somewhat A lot of dark stuff from Bowie, man.
Here come these kids saying, all right, we've had
Zeppelin
enough.
And, I mean, Pink Floyd, forget about it, man. Yeah, you follow Dark Side of the Moon with Wish You Were Here with Animals and The Wall. It just gets, you know, does this album come with a set of razor blades, man? You know? So Van Halen also, I think, they kind of sparked the whole...
We've had enough.
Laid back. Let's get back to rock and roll, the primal instinct and the primal urge of that early rock and roll. They didn't sound like it, but their attitude sure as fuck was, you know, reflected in that first record.
Dude, they toured,
and their second record and their third.
They
and their
toured fourth. Early on with Journey and were blowing Journey off the stage for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But just blowing Journey off the stage and out partying them and out fucking doing everything. And you know, they went into, he went into depth in that book, their touring manager, about the stuff that they were pulling on tour. And it was just like almost like a challenge. We're going to be harder, edgier, you know, everything that you're not, we're going to be. And we're going to go out there for an hour and fucking blow you off the stage. And they did.
Yeah.
You know, they were really, really known for their live shows. And it all stemmed from that first record. You know, going back to that logo, they, early on, they decided to copyright that themselves, obviously, and they were in charge of all the marketing behind that, for like selling the t-shirts and selling, they did all that stuff themselves. I think I even said it on air once how they had like their private security team was always in touch in every city with the local police and were always watching for people counterfeiting their shirts, and it would fucking like harass the shit out of them.
Yeah.
So they always tipped the police in the local towns really well. But that went on when they devised that and they all got their cuts out of it. That went on throughout their entire career, man. I'm assuming there's some sort of thing still going, but it went on throughout their entire career. So, I mean, it was once they wised up, they really wised up and they started making the money.
Yeah.
Because they got so, you know, they got screwed so bad on that first record, the first couple of records, really.
It's funny because looking back, and I think, Rolling Stone magazine, I think they were one of the few publications that actually acknowledged that, hey, we fucked up, years later when they went back and just kind of
Rolling Stone.
No. But there was, you know, the album was not very widely praised when it first came out by critics. But, you know, if you think about the critics in the 70s, they were largely that holier than thou era, the people that largely wrote the story, capital S, of rock and roll, when, you know, your Rolling Stone people, you know, you Dave Marsh's and your, not Dave Marsh, but, you know, Jan Wenner.
Jan, that's a good thing of his fucking name.
Whoever else.
Fucking Jan.
Who are some of the, well, Robert Christgau, who, you know, wrote for the, you know, he was like, I later used to read him in a Village Voice, but I'm just going to go through some quotes here. This was on February 78 when the record first came out. So Chris Gow said he gave the album a negative review, writing, "For some reason, Warner wants us to know that this is the biggest bar band in the San Fernando Valley. The term becomes honorific when the music belongs in a bar. The music belongs on an aircraft carrier. Or this music belongs on an aircraft carrier."
I think that's a fucking compliment because it does belong on a fucking aircraft carrier. How about that?
A 1938 critic, Charles M. Young. Now, was that the same? No, I'm thinking of somebody else. Okay, I'm thinking of Charles Cross. That was the guy that wrote the book, the book on Cobain.
Charles M. Young, you're in the fucking crosshairs.
"In 3 years, Van Halen is going to be fat and self-indulgent and disgusting, following Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin right into the toilet." Now, this is 1978, okay?
What a prick.
Yeah. "In the meantime, they are likely to be a big deal." He also wrote that. Same guy also wrote that. "Van Halen's secret is not doing anything that's original while having the hormones to do it better than all those bands who have become fat and self-indulgent and disgusting."
How is he? What did he listen to the same record?
"Edward Van Halen has mastered the art of lead / rhythm guitar in the tradition of Jimmy Page and Joe Walsh. Several riffs on this record beat anything Aerosmith has come up with in years. Vocalist David Lee Roth manages the rare hard rock feat of infusing the largely forgettable lyrics with energy and not sounding like a castrato at the same time."
Admittedly, he's not a great singer.
"Drummer Alex Van Halen and bassist Michael Anthony are competent and properly unobtrusive."
Oh my God! What now fucking this is, record did that guy listen to?
These are the two major critics at the at the time. In 1978, you're got one representing the Village Voice and the other representing Rolling Stone.
I can't even imagine that review.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be an open-minded rock journalist? I mean, come on. Everybody who listens to this show, whether you're a Van Halen fan or not, that record changed things, man. Again,
putting it in the context of the times where, we're looking back on it in retrospect, that with all of the history is behind it.
Yeah, but some fucking schlub like Charles M. fucking whatever his name was, Charles M. Young.
Right.
He was probably fucking 60 years old or 48, 9, 50 years old. He wasn't about Van Halen. That's not what Van Halen was about.
Yeah.
They had the wrong fucking, a guy that would have been in his 20s, 30s, that's the guy you send out to listen to that record, go out and see Vic and Van Halen at a show.
I think those guys on Rolling Stones, the guy that Wenner had on his staff weren't that old. In the 70s,
no,
I think they were young.
Yeah, he wanted to be that hip.
It was kind of like Rolling Stone
fuck
was still
though.
That magazine. Although in 78 they had moved to New York City, they had gone from San Francisco. They started portraying pop culture as opposed to.
I don't even want to talk about that.
The counterculture.
Anymore.
They were first a countercultural magazine. And
I loved it. I used to have the subscription. I loved it. I read it all the time.
Yeah.
They broke. They were one of the first magazines to really write about MP3s and where they were going and stuff like that.
They were relevant.
They were very relevant. And but when you put the fucking bomber of the fucking Boston Massacre on your cover of a fucking Rolling Stone magazine, I'm done with you. Goodbye.
Yeah. Well,
I
mean,
pick it up.
Yeah. They've always done that. They've always done stuff like that. I mean, they had Charles Manson and they got into the whole.
Yeah, but Manson was a different thing. Manson was still tied to music. He was still tied to music.
Yeah.
What was the face of that kid fucking tied to? What was he tied to? Nothing.
I'm not condoning it. I'm just, Rolling Stone was that. It was nothing new. It was nothing new for them, yeah. I think
they stepped over the line.
I think Patty Hearst was on the cover, that whole, whatever that was going on with her, that Liberation Army was going on.
I can't believe the fucking reviews. I'm blown away by that review. What a good find.
Yeah. This was actually
M.
on their wiki page, man.
Fuck you, Charles M. Young. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, but you know what? It was not the first review that they got wrong. They went back and corrected Pet Sounds after Paul McCartney came out and said it influenced Sgt. Pepper. People were trashing Pet Sounds when it came out, too. There was some other things in here, but it was just kind of funny. But Running with the Devil, Eruption, you really got me. I mean, you cover a Kinks song 10 years after, that was great. That was flawless. The one that for me Ain't Talking About Love. That's the riff that the one that you wish you wrote.
Yeah.
The opening riff of Ain't Talking About Love.
That's like Keith Richards, like Jumpin' Jack Flash or something. You know what I mean? That's the riff that you wrote.
My favorite songs are always the minor keys. I like minor keys, but somebody could take like a minor a song in a minor key and make it sound so happy and uplifting and just so kick ass. That's
the
a
riff you wish you wrote. I like that. The riff you wish you wrote.
Yeah. And then there are things that I wasn't crazy about. To this day, I can't dig Jamie's Crying. And the fact that it came back in the form of, what was that song that there was a rapper that sang?
Yeah, who was that? He was in the Ace Ventura movie, Tone Loc.
Probably like,
you know why.
So on the flip side of Ain't Talking About Love, I think one of the most annoying riffs ever written was the riff from Jamie's Crying, man. I can never dig that.
Hear about it later off of Fair Warning. Oh, my God. The beginning of that is just so brilliant. So good.
And then you just got like sick, just sick. And I mean sick in a good way. Fucking sick, man. Atomic Punk. What the
Sinner like, Swing.
Just shit that was never done before. You didn't hear anything remotely like Atomic Punk before that song existed. Feel Your Love Tonight, not one of my favorites.
It's a little cheesy.
But you got it's another element of Van Halen was the background vocals. Now again, I wasn't crazy about it, but who the fuck am I, man? I'm one person. There was a lot of call and response going on with Van Halen in Jamie's Crying, where David says something, man, and then you hear Eddie or you know, Michael Anthony and whoever Eddie did some back. There was like a lot of conversation going on in their songs, you know, and that was new. You didn't hear a lot of that. There was a lot of traces of, I don't want to say like, what's a word I'm looking for? Not doo-wop, man, but just harmonized vocals, background vocals in a hard rock band. You didn't like the ballsiness of Van Halen, bands that sounded like that, that played that kind of music. You didn't hear a lot of harmony background vocals, a lot of stuff that was going on like that.
Yeah,
you know, they were primarily lead singer.
You started hearing that
bands
after them for sure.
You know, there was, Zeppelin had no background vocals.
You have choruses.
Very little. There were no Zeppelin had no choruses. We got to do a show on that, man. Why did Zeppelin never have no choruses in their songs?
All of My Love might be like the only one, right? Because he repeats it throughout the song.
It's just verse, riff, verse, riff, verse, riff, verse, riff.
But you know what was unique about that is that he told story. It was a story. He told a complete story, which is really cool. Well, then you get bands who have too many choruses. The Doors, Hello, I Love You.
And another thing that's very obvious about the Van Halen is, you know, records had a very unique sounds. Like, you know, bands that kind of, you know, this sounds like this, and this song sounds like this, and this song sounds like this. Every song on that record is unique and different. Like, nothing sounds like the one before it.
They had a lot of time to hone that.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think by the second, third records, they started, you know, their sound kind of fell into place, I think. You know, you had a lot of time before that first record where they were just playing, you know, as Mammoth or whatever, and playing clubs and playing parties. And
everything is a different rhythm. Everything's a different speed. Yeah. Everything, the energy is a different energy in each song. Little Dreamer to this day remains probably my favorite Van Halen song.
Hmm.
Either that or I'll Wait.
I'll Wait is great. It's such a great song.
There's
something
dreamlike and mystical to the sound of Little Dreamer. Yeah.
I like Hear About It Later a lot. But I'll Wait is just, it's one of those songs, and it's the last, you know, it's the last good Van Halen record. And then it's amazing how that song is on
you
there.
You know, I mean, not to get too much into, is that, you don't think 5150 was a good record?
It's, I don't really consider it a Van Halen record.
Okay.
I don't.
All right, fair enough.
And that's, I love 5150. And when it first came out, I was like, whoa, this is really fucking good. And, you know,
I am not any means a fan of the Sammy Hagar era, man, but I 5150, I thought was a great album. I think it's one of their better records.
There's some stuff
their entire catalog.
There's some stuff that they did with Sammy I think is great.
Yeah.
But I think they got too tuned into the Love This, I Love You, the man and the woman thing. But the songs that they didn't are really good. You know, there's some powerhouses there. Summer Nights comes into mind. I thought it was a fucking great song by them. But like Dreams, I could live without that one.
Yeah.
I could live without it. What else by Sammy?
It's a great pop song.
It is. It is a good pop song.
And, you know, it's Van Halen is debatable. I mean, it's in the Van Halen catalog. And, you know, just kind of pushing aside, you know, it's not David Lee Roth and it doesn't belong to this first group of five or six albums or whatever.
Mm.
I still think it's as strong in its own way as some of their better records. I just think it's, you know, that's just my opinion.
Wow.
And I haven't even listened to the album in like 30 years.
I haven't listened to it in a very long time.
But I was thinking about it. Where would 5150? Like, I was trying to think about how I would rank the Van Halen albums. And surprisingly, just being totally honest with myself, man, and I would put 5150 in the top five. But I'll leave it at that. Because talking about that.
Yeah,
and I'm not talking about like, oh, it's better. You know, it's just I'm talking about beginning to end, just as an album that doesn't really have that many holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of it, I just think that like when you think about when you get into, and this is like I don't want to sound like Eddie Trunk, but and this is the last thing I'll say about the Sammy Hagar era, because that's Eddie Trunk. You know? And this is the last thing I'll say about the Sammy Hagar era. I don't think OU812 touches 5150. And I don't even think the other album after it touches 5150.
Was Balance or For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge next? There's a song called Amsterdam on Balance.
Amsterdam
is fucking killer.
I don't think Amsterdam. I think Amsterdam's on the other one.
I thought it was on Balance.
you might be right, but I kind of remember Amsterdam earlier.
For a lawful carnal knowledge had right now on it, which I actually do like.
I don't like that. I really hate it right now.
And then he rips back into the lead guitar work on it. It's interesting that you and I disagree on that song.
Yeah, see, that's when they're like, oh, Van Halen became a pop band and this and that after, you know, it's true.
'84 was a pop record. Rock was different then.
Yeah, but it still had Hot for Teacher in Panama, and you know there was good stuff on there, man.
Yeah, but it was still a pop record. I mean, MTV fucking loved. They were the darlings of MTV, man.
Yeah,
the darlings of MTV. So much so that they went back and played like footage, promotional video footage of them doing like Unchained and Hear About It Later and shit like that.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's how much they were darlings to MTV. They were in that group of acts that helped build that fucking station.
Yeah, true. Although they really didn't do videos up until like their first big one. It got banned.
Yeah,
when they did
Dive
Her Down.
Or Pretty Woman.
Yeah, and Dive Her Down was kind of like, I mean, I think 5150 is a better album than Dive Her Down. I have no problem saying that. You know, Dive Her Down was kind of like, it was just like this rushed, like it was just kind of like threw these scraps and put it together with a couple of cover songs. It has its good moments, but I'll take 5150 over that record.
That's something I'm going to have to look at again.
I don't know. Where else do we want to go with this? I do want to acknowledge, though, I have to say, for the other metalheads out there, man, yesterday was another anniversary. A couple anniversaries yesterday. One was the 20th anniversary, if you're a hipster and you're into hipster indie rock, In the Airplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel turned 20. Yesterday, I think that's I'll say this, and this is the last thing I'll say on indie rock. First and last thing, that album by Neutral Milk Hotel is a masterpiece, and it was the last, in my opinion, it's just Mikey D here, the last great rock album of the 90s.
Pat's sleeping.
Yeah. All right, and the other one, the other big anniversary, as far as I'm concerned, man. And I know you agree with me, if you're a metalhead. Stained Class.
Oh, I'm up now. I'm awake now.
Judas Priest's fourth album, Stained Class, came out.
Masterpiece.
40 years ago, February 1978. Arguably the record where Judas Priest became Judas Priest.
It's a masterpiece. There's no other word for it. It's a masterpiece.
Priest was spotty on their first three albums. I like their first three albums. Rock-A-Rolla, where they very much sounded like if Black Sabbath and Deep Purple had a baby with bad production.
Like that. I like that.
Horrible production.
Yeah, I like that.
Rock-A-Rolla has some really good gems on it. Sad Wings of Destiny's got The Ripper, Victim of Changes, Dreamer, Deceiver.
Good record.
Great record. My problem with it, it's probably the most horrible stereo mix in all rock history.
So the production level.
So it's like if you have like one speaker blown, you're only going to get music and no vocals because all the vocals are on one speaker. Sad Wings of Destiny, great album.
Awesome.
Sin After Sin. Has great songs on it. There was something about the production I didn't like. It was too much. I was just talking to Stick last night about this. We were kind of like disagreeing on this, man. But like songs like Sinner, Diamonds and Rust, I think the definitive versions are on Unleashed in the East.
That's interesting. I love Diamonds. Diamonds is probably one of my favorite pieces.
Yeah. The Bob Dylan connections to Judas Priest, man. Diamonds and Rust, the song Joan Baez wrote to Bob Dylan. Mm. Judas Priest, The Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest obviously comes from a Bob Dylan song.
Yeah.
It's Sin After Sin, their third album produced by Roger Glover, wasn't, you know, it was, again, it was hit and miss. It was a little spotty. Stained Class comes out, man. They got this guy, Les Binks, on the drums. They no longer have, because Priest had a drummer on every album. Simon Phillips did Sin After Sin. A guy named Alan Moore did the second album. John Hinch was their first drummer, I believe. But anyway, you had songs like Exciter and White Heat, Red Hot and Savage and Beyond the Realms of Death. These all became classics.
Song.
I think that through the 80s, Priest kind of ignored Stained Class. It became this record that during Priest's commercial peak from Screaming for Vengeance and let's say British Steel, Point of Entry, Screaming for Vengeance, Defenders of the Faith through Turbo. All right, those five albums, that block of five albums, and every time you saw Priest in concert, they kind of forgot about Stained Glass. Mm. It was this album that they played for like 3 years, songs here up until about 1981, and then they forgot about it. And the tragic, you know, the two kids that shot themselves, and then suddenly this album's on trial.
Yeah.
You know, Better By You, Better Than Me, which happened to be a cover song. So it was a Spooky Tooth song. And Rob Halford is now on the witness stand, and he's trying to defend his use of his vocal
satanic
technique
fucking
that they masked this thing or whatever. Yeah. They had this subliminal,
do it,
get a gun and blow your face off.
Yeah.
The
Suicide
album became this little footnote, you know, it was like the asterisks. This album is forgotten about. We don't talk about it. We don't play it, but it was also featured in a court case where Judas Priest was blamed for, you know, killing a kid. Or did the kid die? I guess he died.
I think he did commit suicide. I think.
Or no, he shot himself and he lived.
Oh, he lived.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Not pretty.
Ozzy was pretty. Suicide Solution was another one that was all involved in the whole thing. Wine is fun. Whiskey's quicker.
Yeah.
Suicide is
I think rock needs this, man. They need some sort of publicity. Like I said, you know, whatever, like somebody go and
do something bad to a Priest album.
Put Priest back on trial.
Do something stupid.
We need
even a singer.
Rock
have
needs
a singer,
the publicity.
Have a singer just pull his pants down and parade around fucking Manhattan. Do something dumb like that. Or, you know, spill a drink on a fucking on one of the Kardashians at the fucking table next to you and tell her to go fuck herself and get thrown out of the restaurant. You know what I mean? I mean, like, physically thrown out. And as you're getting thrown out, the cover of the Post has you fucking being held and telling everybody to go fuck off. Do something like that.
Right.
Where is that anymore?
Yeah.
A bunch of fucking little sissy nannies. What's Ed Sheeran going to do? Spill his drink and say, oh, I'm sorry. My mistake, mate. Fuck you.
Oh,
don't be afraid of Kanye West. Punch him in his fucking nose.
The one thing that stands out with me is I always remembered this. Going to see Priest, and we used to see Priest every year from back the Screaming for Vengeance tour. And with me, I'm like the guy that likes the rare song on side two, you know, the obscure stuff. I never cared about the hits. So when they played Breaking the Law and, you know, Heading Out to the Highway and all that stuff, You Got Another Thing Coming, it's like, okay, man, this is fun, but, you know, if there's ever a bathroom song, you got to take
a
piss,
get
up, you know, okay. Living After Midnight, stuff like that. I was just like, why don't they ever play something from Stained Glass? You know, I wish they would play something from, my favorite song at the time was Beyond the Realms of Death, and the title track, Stained Glass, you know. I think Glenn Tipton's the greatest thing Glenn Tipton ever played. It's one of my favorite guitar solos ever, is Beyond the Realms of Death.
It's a fantastic song.
And Screaming for Vengeance, nothing. Defenders of the Faith tour, nothing. Turbo tour, nothing. So, summer of 1988, Ram It Down comes out. In the spring of 1988, and
Rob Halford trying to tell us something.
At this point, I'm losing interest in Priest. You know, I'm losing interest in metal at this point because I started listening to Bob Dylan. I started listening, going back into, you know, I was into REM. I started just totally listening to other stuff, getting more introspective and just looking for more in the lyrics as opposed to the music. And but I was still hanging on to Priest. I got Ram It Down when it came out. You know, even 2 years later, I got Painkiller when it came out. And I remember going, you know, Stick and I and a couple of our friends, we went to see the Ram It Down tour, and they're following the same set list with, you know, the same set list as Turbo and Defenders of the Faith, and, you know, with, you know, insert new songs here, insert songs from the, you know, the obligatory
new
songs
album,
okay.
Yeah.
And then somewhere in the middle of the show, so we're going to play a song we haven't played in a long time from an album we haven't done anything from in a very long time. This is from the Stained Glass album. This is Beyond the Realms of Death.
Wow.
To this day, man, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds of concerts, man.
That's
and
your
God
spot.
Knows, man, the best concerts I've been to are Bruce Springsteen shows.
Yeah.
I have never screamed so fucking loud, man,
cool,
and been that ecstatic at a fucking concert, man, since I saw Priest play Beyond the Realms of Death in 1988 on the Ram It Down tour.
That's awesome.
You
That's
know, I've had
story.
A few close moments, like New York City Serenade, seeing that for the first time, yeah, that Bruce do that, you know, in 1999. But yeah, so Stained Class, man, it's a, it's not unless you're a hardcore Priest fan, it's not very widely known in, you know, in terms of the mainstream general consensus of, you know, what people are exposed to in metal. You know, Judas Priest, you know, the average typical fan out there that knows Priest, you know, oh, You Got Nothing Coming, Living After Midnight, their 80s stuff, you know. Stained Class is a must. It is easily one of the top two Priest albums, two or three Priest albums. It's arguably their best, but, you know, I mean, sometimes I say Screaming for Vengeance is their best.
People don't understand how many covers they did. You know, I had a couple of moments like that, though, yeah, where a band did a song where I was just like, oh, okay, that's that moment. Melissa, seeing the Allman Brothers play Melissa for the first time.
Yeah.
Because they didn't do it that often live. Or if they did, I didn't see it. Right. But it was great. And another was when I saw Pink Floyd and they opened up with Shine On You Crazy Diamond, the giant stadium.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the sound system, and it felt like the old giant stadium was going to lift off the ground.
And you said exactly the same thing in our very first episode when we were talking about, it's like, so tremendous. you know it's tremendous. Was that one of your best if
concert
you could
experiences?
Pinpoint like your greatest, not necessarily the state of mind you were in, bless you.
Thank you.
Oh,
I was in a state of mind too, but I remember.
You know what's funny, man? When I edit, man, I always say like editing is good for like ums and mans and likes and sneezes and coughs, man. I think in 42 episodes that may have been our first sneeze on the air. I've never had to cut a sneeze out.
My daughter's home sick, so I'm hoping it's not rubbing off.
Oh, great! Probably that flu going around.
That's crazy. I forgot that I mentioned that in the first episode of that show.
Yeah, and you said it exactly the same way, man. It's just I know what you mean, man. I saw the Division Bell. It was it may have been that show. I don't know, but
no, it was before Division Bell. It was
okay.
Christ, learning
momentary lapse of suck ass.
Is that the one with learning to fly?
Yeah,
on it?
Yeah.
Momentary lapse.
I didn't see that at Giant Stadium. I saw that at the Garden.
I saw Giant Stadium and Brendan Byrne.
Okay.
It was crazy, man, with the bed fucking flying. It was just,
in fact, I still have.
The dude worshiping the pig as it's flying over. It was
for
wacky.
Some reason, I lost my ticket stub for the momentary lapse of reason. I have the Division Bell, but for some reason, I don't have my ticket stub. But I still have the New Jersey Transit, the little pink New Jersey Transit slip that says Pink Floyd concert. October 8th, 1987, you know, or whatever fucking date it was. Oh, man. Good times.
Yeah, man.
Anyway. Oh, there are these people that are killing me here with this. I don't care what's going on in Russia now. All right. You want to wrap up?
Yeah.
And we'll leave it at that, man. Celebrating two great landmark albums. Well, the Van Halen is more of a landmark album. The Priest album is more just like very important in their evolution because it was the really...
You know, I
first metal sounding album.
They did a lot of covers,
did.
Man. Green Metalicia too. That was a Fleetwood Mac song.
Yeah,
right?
Green Metalicia.
That's
Diamonds and Rust.
That's crazy how many covers they did. And then Van Halen did a lot of covers as well. That's pretty nuts.
They went and did. I hated that Johnny B. Goode cover. I don't know what they were thinking when he did that. See that also
they got
hurt.
Paid
Ram
a lot
it
of
down.
Money.
Ram
got,
It Down wasn't a great album.
They got paid a lot of money.
Yeah. But anyway, Rock Under Fire, rockunderfire.com, Rock Under Fire on Facebook, Rock Under Fire on iTunes, on YouTube, on Stitcher,
on your underpants.
Else, on, yes, yes, yes. Awesome.
Love you.
See you next time. Pouring on me, bad news keep pouring on me, bad news keep pouring on me.